Good morning, Carborough and Chapel Hill. This is your wake-up call, brought to you each week on Friday morning at this time by the Triangle Branch of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Now in our 75th year of service to the Triangle, working for justice and peace. Our website is TriangleWILF, that's TriangleWILPF.org. I'm Dick Paddock. Our engineer this morning is Tana Hartman. Good morning, Tana. Our guest this morning is second-generation member of WILF, Sister Lucy Lewis, a resident of Carborough. There is an event that happened in Greensboro 30 years ago next week, November 3, 1979, known as the Greensboro Massacre. The simple description of the event is that a group of people struggling for justice on behalf of workers in North Carolina's textile mills held a rally in a neighborhood in Greensboro known as Morningside Homes. A group of men later identified as Klan and Nazis drove up in a caravan and were recognized and shouted at by the rally members, subsequently in full view of a TV news camera and thus recorded on videotape. The men brought out handguns, rifles, and shotguns, opened fire, and killed five of the rally organizers and wounded several others. The attackers then calmly got back in their cars and drove away. Lucy, will you take it from there? What is the background of the victims, and why were they there?
Good morning, Dick. Thanks for having me today. I was good friends with the five people that were killed, and I'd like to tell you a little bit about them. Three of them, Jim Waller, Sandy Smith, and Bill Sampson, had been organizing in North Carolina textile mills for a number of years, and they were all leading textile efforts at Cone Mills plants. Dr. Jim Waller had for many years worked with poor people in need. He trained at the Lincoln Hospital Collective in New York City. He'd worked with at Wounded Knee to aid American Indian Movement activists under siege, and he'd organized brown lung screenings in North Carolina. And he left medicine to work and organize in Haw River and had been elected president of his local Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union. Bill Sampson was another one of those who was murdered that day. He had been president of his college student body, had studied divinity at Harvard Theological School, at Harvard Divinity School, and he also, like Bill, had left medicine to organize and work in the Greensboro Cone textile mills, and he was running it for president of his local. And the third textile organizer that was murdered that day was Sandy Smith. She had been president of the student body college at Bennett College and an activist on behalf of African-American students. She'd been working at the Greensboro Cone Mill textile plant. One of the issues she'd been involved in was sexual harassment of women workers. She'd recently left the Cone Mill plant to go work in Kannapolis to work in the textile mills there. Two of the other people that were killed that day were also working on economic justice issues and were labor organizers. Cesar Calce was a Cuban immigrant who had attended Duke. And then he had gone on to work at Duke Hospital and was working on the drive there to organize hospital workers. And Mike Nathan, a doctor like two of the others that were killed, had been working, instead of working at a lucrative medical practice, had been the pediatrician at Lincoln Community Hospital in Durham, North Carolina. And the reason that people had gathered there that day, and I was one of those there, was because in 1979 we'd seen an upsurge in racist violence. As folks, many of our listeners will remember, 1979 was in some ways a shadow of what we're seeing today, that we'd seen an increase in double-digit inflation, unemployment was on the rise, and as often happens at a time when the economy is in bad shape, that's a time when racist and hate groups have used that fear and anxiety and worry among people to really try to build up their own ranks. And we had seen throughout the South that summer an increase in Klan organizing. Down in Decatur, Alabama, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference had been attacked at an anti-Klan rally. There had been struggles in Decatur, Alabama. And those who are working to strengthen the labor movement here in North Carolina felt that it was really important as part of their organizing work to talk about the roots of the Klan and how historically there had been efforts to divide black and white workers. So there were actually plans for an educational conference on November 3rd to talk about the history of white supremacy, the history of the struggle against that effort, and it was going to be preceded by an anti-Klan rally going from Morningside Heights, which is a historically African-American community, to the community center where the educational conference was to be held. And of course, as you said, the attack by the Klan and Nazis that day, which ended in the death of these five wonderful young people and the wounding of 10 others, prevented that conference from ever taking place.
So what was the follow-up to this attack?
The reason I think that the records have shown, journalists who've dug into the story have shown, investigations have shown that the attacks really took place, is because the organizing was a real threat to the status quo in Greensboro and in North Carolina. One of the things that happened November 3rd was that the police had promised to provide protection. They were nowhere to be seen that day. In fact, they had been on site and left, and we found out afterwards that they had been given instructions to take an early lunch break. And so when the Klan and Nazis came through and opened fire, there was no one there to protect the legally called demonstration and the demonstrators. And afterwards, a huge amount of fear and hysteria was whipped up in the Greensboro community. And that was the context in which there were two subsequent trials. There was first a state trial and then a federal trial of some of the Klan and Nazis. And in both of those cases, all white juries were convened. And the demonstrators, or the Klan and Nazis, were found not guilty. The widows and friends and families of those who were murdered had hoped to call as those responsible were not just the Klan and Nazis, but agents of the Greensboro Police and of the State Bureau of Investigation and Federal Bureau of Investigation, as well as the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, because agents in all of those groups were actually complicit in what took place. And it took a third trial, a civil trial, that was brought by the widows and families of those murdered to have a multiracial jury in which there was a finding of guilt. And it was the first time ever that the Klan, the Nazis, and police, the city of Greensboro, were found jointly liable in the murder of one of the demonstrators, Michael Nathan. This complicity between a white supremacist hate groups and police and federal agents actually is not unprecedented. We know about the FBI complicity in the 60s when there were demonstrators from Freedom Summer and SNCC and other groups actively organizing. But this was one of the few times that actually there was enough successful digging into the facts to be able to unearth the fact that not only were the police not there, but that they had been complicit in what took place, that there had been a police photographer, for example, who had trailed the Klan Nazi caravan to the site, that the group that organized the demonstration had been under investigation by the FBI, and that in fact it was a federal agent, Bernard Butkovich, with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, who had worked to build a united front between the Ku Klux Klan and the Nazis with the intent of breaking up the rally that day. So what we saw after this terrible murder, which took place, as you said, in front of television cameras, were two jury trials in which those who were guilty were not brought to justice. And in the civil suit, of course, there were no criminal charges. However, there was a fine that was levied against the Ku Klux Klan, the Nazis, and the city of Greensboro. Interestingly enough, it was the city of Greensboro that decided to pay the fine of $360,000 on behalf of all those who were found guilty. And many people have long suspected that that was an effort to continue to buy the silence of those who actually carried the guns that day. When the money was awarded to Marty Nathan, who was the widow of Dr. Mike Nathan, the demonstrator who was found guilty, she divided the money up among the survivors, but encouraged them to return that money to develop a fund that could be used to organize to continue the work of those who were killed that day in November. And so the Greensboro Justice Fund was established with that blood money to be able to support organizing efforts in the South for the issues of racial and social and economic justice that have been so important to those who had been killed that day. So for the last 25 years, the Justice Fund has given grants to groups, particularly small groups, grassroots groups, folks who don't have large overhead, or even emergency grants to people who find themselves in a situation where they quickly need protection, or they need a lawyer, or needed some kind of intervention. So that's a legacy of what happened in November 3rd, 1979, of which those of us who were survivors of that day are very proud.
I believe that there's a film about, at least one film, about the massacre itself, and a book along with it. Could you give us the names of those?
There have actually been a number of films that were done. One of those was a Frontline PBS special called 88 Seconds in Greensboro. There's also a film by Adam Zucker called Closer to the Truth, and that's actually going to be shown in Greensboro next week on, I believe it's Thursday, and Adam will be there to talk about the film and answer questions. There have been several books about those. One is The True Story of the Greensboro Massacre, written by Sally and Paul Bermanson. Sally went on to write another more extensive book, Through Survivors' Eyes, and one of the widows of those who murdered Signe Waller Foxworth also details what happened. Both the facts of the demonstration and the aftermath, but also the larger context, the stories of those people who were killed, and the fact that, of course, although this is a really significant event in North Carolina and Southern history, it's only part of a long struggle that's been going on for many, many years, and will continue, we hope, the struggle for racial justice and economic justice.
Yes, it's been a struggle that's spanned probably at least two centuries. When you look back over the whole span of the struggle for economic and racial justice.
That's right. Slavery began in this country more than two centuries ago, when the first African Americans were brought in chains to this country. And there has been resistance and struggle ever since that time. So that as much as we use this 30th anniversary to look back and remember what happened that day, we never forget the context in which it took place. And to remind our listeners that the 60s were actually just the culmination of decades and decades of struggle by black people in this country, along with their white allies, to address not just overturning slavery, but the white supremacist ideology that supported slavery and that has been in place for so many years since then. So that the struggle in Greensboro to organize labor movements in a region that has been torn apart by racism, where black and white workers have been pit against each other for so many years to prevent successful struggles for economic justice, as just part of a long legacy. These particular events, of course, which the attacks that took place because the organizing was a real threat to the status quo in Greensboro and in North Carolina in the South, have been covered up and distorted. So it's a important part of our history to reclaim that as part of this long and continuing struggle for racial and economic justice here in North Carolina and in the South.
I plan to ask you to go into that some more, in particular, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. But first, we need to have a little break. We need to remind you folks of our underwriter, Internationalist Books and Community Center, which is at 405 West Franklin Street. And you can find it online at internationalistbooks.org. This is WCOMFM.org is the location of the website for the station. And you can go to that website and look under podcasts for earlier broadcasts in our series. We have over a year's worth, approaching 2 years of podcasts available. And you can also, on the main page of WCOMFM.org, you can find a button that will allow you to stream this program or any program live through your computer. And remind you that this is brought to you by Triangle Wilf at trianglewilf.org. And let's go back now and talk to Lucy about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Go ahead.
Well, we've already talked about one of the legacies of the November 3rd, 1979 Greensboro Massacre, which was the Greensboro Justice Fund, which was established with the money that was paid in fines by the city of Greensboro for the murder of five labor and anti-racist organizers. Another legacy that came out of it didn't take place until much later. It was at the 20th commemorative events of the 1979 murders that a discussion developed about what it would take to really reveal the facts of what had happened that day, the context in which they had taken place, the significance of what had occurred, and what it means for our struggle going forward. And the fact that although in many places around the country, many people seem to know more about the truth of what had happened than in Greensboro or in North Carolina, where there had been conscious efforts to really cover up what had happened that day. And people began talking about the possibility of establishing a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Greensboro. We, the members of the Greensboro Justice Fund, the Board of Directors, and members of the Beloved Community Center, which has been organizing in Greensboro for over two decades now, began to talk with folks with the International Center for Transitional Justice, which was established after the South Africa Truth and Reconciliation Commission, did its work to take the lessons of South Africa and use those in countries around the world that were struggling to reconcile violent histories with coming together and being able to move forward. And we began to talk to the ITCJ, the International Center for Truth and Justice, about what it would take to have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission here in North Carolina. And I think when we began that discussion, we had no idea about what it would actually take to do this in a serious way that could be used not only to address what had happened in Greensboro, but to try to develop perhaps a model that could be used in other communities and other states and other regions of this country. So we took this project really seriously and began to lay the groundwork for a Truth and Reconciliation here. Those who had developed a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, of course, were dealing with the aftermath of the ending of apartheid there in the mid-1990s. Here we had South Africa, which had been torn by tremendous oppression of the Africans, South Africans, by the minority white ruling party. Had then had to reconcile. Where do we go now that we've gotten rid of legal apartheid? How do we bring together black, white, and colored South Africans to be able to build a future? and had discovered, had developed a process of how, of hearings where people could come forward and tell their stories, both victims and perpetrators, and talk about potential amnesty for those who had perpetrated the injustices and the oppression, to try to bring together the different communities in South Africa and build a future. So that was the model that we used. There was a convening of commissioners, seven different community leaders who came together. Five were from Greensboro. One, Cynthia Brown, was a former city council member of Durham, and one, Pat Clark, was the head of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. They met over a period of many months, hearing from community members, survivors of November 3rd, members of the Morningside community, labor historians in North Carolina, those involved in the struggle for economic justice, as well as members of the Ku Klux Klan. Those hearings and that truth that was revealed was used to compile a report with their best analysis of what had taken place that day. Of course, some people still refused to come forward and testify. We still weren't able to hear from federal and state agents. But there was the most comprehensive and exhaustive pulling together of the facts of that day, which found that the police and federal and state agents had in fact been complicit in what occurred, not just in the murder of one demonstrator, but in all of the events of that day, and recommendations for the future, which are really important. They talked about the need for changes in how the police conduct their affairs in Greensboro, about the need to further the work of the Greensboro Human Relations Commission, about the need to work for more equitable situations for workers in the textile mills. A whole series of recommendations were developed, and people, particularly in the Beloved Community Center and those working with that Center for Justice in Greensboro, have continued to work for those recommendations in the years since then.
This was the first in the country, as I understand it.
That's right. The Greensboro Truth and Reconciliation was the first here. There have been others, of course, held throughout the world after the South Africa Truth and Reconciliation Commission. There have been Truth and Reconciliation Commission initiatives in Sri Lanka, in East Timor, in Peru, in Northern Ireland, throughout the world. But Greensboro really developed a model that we believe can be very instructive to other communities that are struggling to reconcile their own histories. Those who were part of the TRC process, which included, of course, not just the seven commissioners, but a local task force, which was co-chaired by former Greensboro Mayor Carolyn Allen, retired Methodist minister Z. Holler, and local minister Reverend Gregory Hedden, have been in touch with communities throughout the United States who are looking at that model. I know they've been in discussion with people in Rosewood, Florida, in Oklahoma, where there were white race riots against the African-American community. And now there is their efforts going on in Mississippi to develop the first statewide Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And I've heard that there are even discussions going on in Maine with fishing communities there. So this is a model that has a lot of implications for how we in this country deal with our own history and our past. And it's a difficult process. It's hard to bring together people who have perpetrated murders like those on November 3rd and those who were victims. And that's why it's called Truth and Reconciliation, because you really can't talk about justice and a future unless you really are willing to acknowledge the truth of what's happened. It's not an easy reconciliation process. South Africa certainly showed that. But if we can't come to terms with our history, we can't move forward, and that we hope that the Greensboro model is one that can be used.
Thank you. I understand that there's going to be some events in the coming week around the 30th anniversary, and I'd like you to outline what's going on in Greensboro.
Sure. Greensboro next week will be the site for a series of workshops, conferences, cultural activities by people from around the state, around the region, and actually from around the country, coming together not only to remember the five people that were killed that day, the 10 people that were wounded, but again, as we've been talking today, about the context in which it took place and the fact that the best tribute that we can pay to those who gave their lives that day is to deepen our commitment to the struggle for racial and economic justice. So the community in the Triad Triangle area is certainly welcome to attend any and all of the programs that are being organized there. Wednesday, November 4th, is going to be a focus on healing and personal and social transformation, talking about the importance of both recognizing the truth and then how do you come to terms and heal. The same thing will be true on next Thursday, November 5th, which we'll talk about, again, survivors coming forward, community members coming forward, telling their stories and healing each other. Then November 5th and November 6th, there's going to be a shift in focus to the struggle today, and there will be speakers talking about worker, immigrants, and community organizing for justice. On Friday, Valdemar Velasquez, who's the founder and lead organizer for the Farm Worker Labor Organizing Committee, will be speaking. And as many of our listeners will know, FLOC is currently engaged in a struggle against R.J. Reynolds. I'm trying to bring pressure on them to provide better wages and working conditions for tobacco workers. And we see that as part of the direct line of the November 3rd struggle. You mentioned earlier a film. Adam Zucker will be there on November 4th to do a showing of Greensboro Closer to the Truth. And then that Saturday, the last day of this commemorative events, will be focused on truth and reconciliation. And members of the International Transitional Center for Justice will be there. Some of the former commissioners will be there. And James Joseph, who's the former ambassador to South Africa and who was ambassador during the transition from apartheid and a member of the Carter administration, will be speaking. And then the final events will be a reception by the Greensboro Justice Fund, which will be making a transition and turning its funds, which have been used in the past to grant money to organizations to support internships for those who are young people today who are working for economic justice. So we invite people to come to Greensboro and join in any or all of those events.
Is there any place that we can get information?
There is a website for the Greensboro's Beloved Community Center, and that is www.belovedcommunitycenter.org. And the phone number, for those of you who may not be web users, is 336-230-0001. Again, belovedcommunitycenter.org for a full list of what's going to be happening next week.
How much time do we have?
You have just 30 seconds.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for coming, Lucy, and telling us some of the history that we don't usually hear, and also inspiring us to go to Greensboro if we have the chance this coming week in order to celebrate the lives of the people who gave their full measure, if we could say. And this is your Women's International League for Peace and Freedom wake-up call. WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. Tune in next week.